Hello and welcome to Academics of PA. My name is Bruce McDonald. I have with me today two outstanding gentlemen, Jeremy Hall from the University of Central Florida, who also happens to be the co-editor of Public Administration View, and John Diamond from Edge Hill University, who also happens to be the co-editor of Teaching Public Administration. So gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bruce. Hi.
The kind of impetus of having you both on stems from a email conversation and a even further back, a kind of Twitter dialogue about the review process, kind of talking about, you know, the status and the what we face in review. So what I kind of want to start off by talking about is maybe thinking about what the biggest challenge that we as editors face, which in a lot of ways is the review process. So I kind of want to ask, when you're thinking about finding reviewers for articles, what do you look for in reviewers? How do you pick them? And how do you really use the reviews that are being provided in the review process? Which I know is a very large, kind of heavy question with lots that goes into it. I thought that might be a nice kind of starting point for the conversation for us.
Sure. I mean, I can jump right in, I guess. It's
go for it.
I would say that the hardest part of the editor's job, really, in terms of things that we don't control, is just getting reviewers to commit. And part of that question was, what do we look for in reviewers and how do we get them on board? Why do we seek their particular talents and expertise? And I think the answer depends a little bit on each manuscript. But for example, you know, I would invite three people to review a manuscript for PAR, and I might look for someone who has the substantive theory knowledge, the conceptual expertise, someone who's written probably extensively on the topic. I might look for someone who has the methodological expertise to evaluate the methods and statistics that are being used in the article. And, I mean, we're an international journal, so quite frequently I look for someone who has on-the-ground knowledge of the way things are actually working in the place where the research was conducted. I mean, if we're looking at public officials in China, I want someone who knows about Chinese government firsthand to be able to give me some insight. So I have very high, very clear ideals when I invite reviewers, in hopes that I can look at those three recommendations and get a good answer to whether or not the piece is suitable for publication. But what often happens is the system breaks down because A, reviewer is not available. B, a reviewer doesn't understand my algorithm for inviting them, and, you know, says something like, this is outside my area of expertise, and declines. And then the third person has had an illness in the family and they decline, and we're back to square one. And so I'm either A, not really getting all of the feedback that I would like to have, or B, I'm at least not getting it from the very best experts the way I perceive them to be sort of associated with the manuscript. So this all comes back to manifest when we get the reviews back. And I'm looking at three reviews very oftentimes that are mixed, one accept, one reject, one revise and resubmit. And then I have to go back and look at who reviewed it and why they were picked, maybe on the second or third round of inviting reviewers. And then I try to, you know, make sense of where the manuscript actually stands in terms of our standards. And it's very difficult, I think, to make that call when you have less than perfect information.
So I think I absolutely echo everything that Jeremy said there. And I think there are two points which I think you made, Jeremy, which I just want to kind of repeat or maybe rephrase in a way. And then there's a couple of things I'd like to say. I think the first is the extent to which, this might sound like an odd thing to say, our kind of colleagues out there fully appreciate and understand the way in which we go about identifying reviewers. So that idea that it's a combination of skills and knowledge and understanding of place, I guess most people would get. But I think there's something else, which is about the person we approach or the people we approach, the hope that we have that they're going to be able to apply that but in a very thoughtful and developmental way that will result, if the recommendation is to accept or to accept with revisions, to get the best possible paper that the journal can expect out of that process. So I think there is a sense in which, and this is the broader point, I think, there is a sense in which I'm not entirely sure that everybody we call on necessarily sees the process as helping the author. I think that reviewers might see it as something that they do, that we do, because the academic community relies on us gifting our time in so many ways. And even when there might be some kind of financial return, like being an examiner or something, it rarely, in my experiences, matches the kind of time you spent on the job. So there is a sense in which we do things for the greater good of the community.
The idea that he raised is actually very important, and you see a very wide variation in the quality of reviews received. You get some that are very short and terse and frank, that say things like, "This is terrible, I wouldn't publish it," which is a useless review because it's not constructive. It's not detailed. It doesn't provide feedback that's constructive to the author in improving their work to send somewhere else. But then you also get very thoughtful, very thorough reviews. And I think unfortunately, it's the people who write the short, terse, frank reviews that are more willing to agree to a review because they know it's not a significant investment of time to write up their thoughts, which is, you know, that's unfortunate. But it's also one of the areas where we see a lot of variation. You just get totally different kinds of reviews from different people based on their understanding and expectations of the peer review process. And I suspect that many of those people were victims of receiving reviews like that early in their careers, and it shaped the way that they respond later in their careers. But, I guess I sought advice when I was first asked to review a manuscript, and the answer that I got about how to do it was to go back and look at the reviews I'd received when I sent manuscripts to a journal, which was, you know, one of the best pieces of advice someone could have given me. And I did. I went back and I looked and I said, okay, I think I understand this. I had some good reviews, and they were thoughtful and they were constructive. And that's the way I've tried to review manuscripts myself throughout my career. But, you know, it's also an art as well as a science. You have to think about the journal itself and what its mission is and what it seeks to publish, as well as the quality of the article itself and the research behind it, because you don't want to, you don't want to say, hey, this is great research, it should be published, and then recognize after the fact that, oh, well, it's probably a better fit for a specialty journal than it is for a generalist journal. So one of those fun and fancy things.
Now, there's a couple of things that have come out of what you and John were, talking about. I think I'll start at the end just because it's probably a little bit fresh in my mind. In thinking about how we actually teach people to review, I don't know how many programs out there actually spend time talking about how to act as a reviewer and how to review a manuscript. We have the paper that we did a couple years ago with Jess Soa, Pat Shields, and Will Hatcher on how to review a manuscript. But I don't know, in terms of in a classroom environment to PhD programs or as faculty working with PhD students, how do we teach people to review? And I think that has led to a lot of people taking how they review from what they themselves have experienced, whether that's they've gotten one sentence reviews or they write massively long, very, very detailed reviews. I'll think one of my own experiences, I had sent out a paper. One reviewer wasn't even a complete sentence. It was a half of a sentence. I don't know if the other half got cut off or what have you. And the second reviewer gave me 6 single-spaced pages. And I remember looking at it going, what the hell? But you know what? Those 6 single-spaced pages made a massive world of difference. It was absolutely fantastic. And whoever that reviewer was, thank you so much for that. But that half sentence, even if it's only a couple sentences, from the editor's perspective is not really helpful, but from the author's perspective, really isn't helpful, because we use the review process twofold: to help improve the manuscripts as we work on them, but then also to provide guidance to the editor. And I think too many people only focus on that guidance to the editor side of things nowadays.
In the UK, so on doctoral programs that I've been involved in, as part of the process of preparing, you know, doctoral students for when they've completed their PhD, the what next, as they enter that kind of early career research of field, I'm not at all convinced that we advise and support them in fully appreciating the roles that they might take on in terms of being journal reviewers. There's suggestions that they might get involved in the academic community, but I don't think we pay sufficient time to that. I mean, then there will be a discussion about how to review, but it's actually fully understanding what a reviewer is. It's a bit like being involved in journals in terms of being involved on editorial boards, or the whole range of roles that you play once having completed your doctorate and then becoming a kind of a researcher tutor. I don't think we pay sufficient attention to that.
John, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's sparked something that I wanted to say while Bruce was talking a moment ago, and that is whether or not we engage in training people to be peer reviewers. I think there are a couple of things that I, in my mind, maybe it's anecdotal, maybe it's statistically significant, I'm not sure. But I get a sense that there are a lot of younger scholars who are so hyper-focused on the tenure track process that they churn out articles and manuscripts and send them to journals left and right, but they're a little bit reticent to review manuscripts due to, you know, frequently cited time constraints or whatever. And I understand research is a huge time constraint when it comes to finding time to review a manuscript. But if you think about what goes into those manuscripts you're writing and sending out, you're asking three or more people to read your work and comment on it. And so for every piece that you're sending out, you're engaging three scholars. And it just seems to me that people would be more appreciative of that. And, you know, when the peer review requests come in from the journals. But the other thing is, I do know, because I have some direct evidence, that some people are in doctoral seminars helping their students to understand what the peer review process is like and how to be a meaningful player in it. I get maybe two or three requests a year from people when I'll send out a manuscript and ask them to review it, and they write back, "Hey, do you mind if I share this with my PhD seminar?" And ask them to review it. And my answer is always, absolutely share it, as long as you maintain the confidentiality and as long as the review that comes back is yours and not your student's. And in fact, I've actually had a person, I think it was Ken Meyer, who asked me a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago, said, "Hey, I would like for you to send me a manuscript to review so that I can use it in my doctoral seminar." And you know, so I know there are people out there who take this very seriously and who are trying to build scholars who understand what goes into it and what's expected of them. And I assume that for everyone that asks me for permission, there must be, you know, 10 times as many who do it without asking permission. So I know some people are out there doing it, and I think it's a very good practice to get people engaged. And there are different ways to do it, you know, whether you're asking them to read a fresh manuscript or whether you take a manuscript you reviewed in the past and shared the manuscript in your review. I think there are different approaches, and certainly you get different perspectives by engaging in a process like that. So, you know, I think there are some ways to do it. There are some folks who are doing it, and I applaud them.
I've done kind of similar to, you know, what you were talking about, where using a manuscript in the classroom and allowing the students to review. And then at the end, after everybody has turned in their assignment, giving a copy of what the actual reviews were to kind of provide a, here's what you came up with, here's what the reviewers came up with that the journal listened to kind of give that comparison aspect a little bit.
So there's something there, isn't there, about the idea of apprenticeship. I don't know whether that's the right word. The idea that, you know, you're learning the skills, you're learning about the role that you're about to play in that broader academic community. And I'm not sure we necessarily do it in the sense of the collective role. I think we might do it in terms of an individual. This is what you could do to advance your career. But something about the joint venture, if you like, that's created through the kind of communities that people are part of.
Yeah, I think that apprenticeship works remarkably well because you're able to get that much more kind of connected, detailed feedback of here's what you missed, here's how to pay attention to the features so you catch those kind of things, or to how to think about the manuscript. As a student working towards my PhD, going through that apprenticeship, as you know, call it, type process for reviewing, really helped shape me as a writer, how I approach, you know, structuring my manuscripts, thinking about what comes next, kind of everything that goes into that research process, because I started thinking about it from what does the reviewer focus on, what does the reviewer think about, that I can start to address ahead of time.
And I think, I suppose I was broadening it slightly, or thinking about one could broaden it by thinking that that's true of the other roles that we play within the academic community, and that in a sense we're constantly developing those roles. So you don't start off being the editor of a journal. You develop all sorts of skills and knowledge and thinking and desires about taking on that role. Just as with the writing process, the review can be so important, even with really experienced researchers and academics, that a good review can help you develop and learn. And it's that sense that we're all in that process.
No, I think you're absolutely right on that. I do want to go back to one thing that Jeremy had mentioned, and that was the concern or aspect that as we have kind of expected more for tenure demands, the number of publications goes up that people are submitting. You know, how do we think about, or how do we approach kind of balancing the drive that everybody has to always publish with the need to have people step into the reviewer role?
There's two kind of sets of interests, or three, I suppose, aren't there, which are not healthy, I don't think. So one is, so I don't know how far it's advanced in the States, but certainly here in the UK, there's that linking with an emphasis on the quality as well as the quantity of papers are linked somehow to your performance. And more generally, the way in which research is audited in UK universities has also been, the other set of interests are the publishers, you know, the journal publishers. So there are different sets of interests which are not necessarily healthy ones, I think, affecting those younger academics who are coming into the securing tenure or aspiring to secure tenure now, which is quite different perhaps than it was maybe 20 years ago.
You know, another aspect of this conversation, I think, is the growth in manuscript submissions, which I think is proportional to impact factor to some extent. Yeah. You know, when Paul and I took over PAR 3 years ago, hard to imagine it's been 3 years looking back, but we were receiving about 550 manuscripts a year. I think that's what we got the first year, or the year that we were transitioning, rather. And now we will probably, if we haven't already, I think we're going to hit 1,000 this year. And so in a very short period of time, we've seen exponential growth in manuscript submissions. Now, why? Why is that? Well, part of it is the tenure demands. Part of it is that we are producing a lot of PhD students who want to publish, but also on the international scale, there are institutions in developing countries that are really beginning to emphasize research in a big way. And I couldn't put a percentage on it, but we get a lot of manuscripts from China now, from institutions that I was previously unfamiliar with, from scholars whom I was previously unfamiliar with. And I think that some of it is the growth in the institutionalization of research in China and in Chinese universities and their desire to be major players on the world stage. I think similar trends are happening elsewhere. We're starting to see manuscripts come in from India. We're seeing more and more coming from Latin America. And so wherever they're coming from, you start to see that there are people who are interested in publishing, and the word about the top journals is out, and they want to, you know, find those that have impact factors that are going to distinguish them in their institutions. And so the end result is we just get a lot of manuscripts. And to be frank, we don't have the reviewer pool to be able to manage that many. It just doesn't go that deep. And so, I would say are desk rejecting at an increasing pace because we can tell pretty readily from a submission that's not going to make it, that it won't make it. And it's just, it's more humane to dismiss it out of the gate than it is to invest reviewer time when that's the case. We have these dueling pressures. Yes, we want good reviews and we want to provide good feedback, but we also have limited capacity and growing demand. And I think it's a very delicate line to have to try to balance.
And just to add to that, that's absolutely right. To add to that is the reason why I think we thought it was a good idea to have this conversation, which was about the discussion that was prompted on Twitter by the review that a young academic had received, which I think those of us that read it felt that it was really, really inappropriate in terms of how dismissive it had been. And that's different from, this is not a good piece of work. And it's different from the bold rejection that Jeremy was talking about. And we do that too in TPA. But it's about how once you've engaged in that review process, what's your responsibility as a reviewer to seek to provide good constructive feedback that someone can learn from, which is where we started earlier on with the points you were making, Jeremy, about what it is you're looking for when you send a paper out.
Right.
I think that's a good point of thinking about what's the responsibility of the reviewer, how do they approach the manuscripts, and it's tricky. One of the things that I don't like about the review process in public administration is that it is double blind. Part of the reason I don't like the double blind aspect is I think it creates, saying troll-like is completely not the right phrase, but maybe it actually is the right phrase. I don't know. But that blindness of not knowing who it is, knowing that the reviewer doesn't know who you are, it allows you more freedom, or kind of creates that feeling of freedom within you that you can say whatever you want to. And you're more than welcome to, kind of like what we see with people on blind Twitter accounts who are going after and trolling people or online discussion boards. That anonymity allows people to say things that they might not otherwise say.
Agreed.
Do I think we'll stop having double blind peer review in public administration? Probably not. There's been a growth in the number of journals from other fields who have started kind of moving away from that. So last year, I think it was Nature, which is a huge journal, they have started, it's a blind peer review process, but once the peer review process is done, the names of the reviewers are published to say, here's who reviewed the manuscript itself. It's kind of almost a hybrid between single blind peer review and fully blind, so that if you get those comments that are kind of out there, somebody's going to know eventually who you were, in order to kind of perhaps in a roundabout way hold you responsible for it.
So I happen to think that's a good idea. And the reason why I think it's a good idea is that I think it, we've kind of assumed or felt, haven't we, that double-blind peer review is the gold standard. It's a marker of quality. But actually, when you look at some of the reviews that we get, and also the example that I was using before about some of the reviews that perhaps younger career researchers get, there's nothing gold standard about those reviews. There's nothing that you would think was helpful in a challenging and critical way. They, in a sense, are the trolls that, you know, follow people on Twitter and engage in comments that they couldn't engage with if they revealed who they were. So I think there's something really important about moving to a position where you might where we could publish the names of reviewers, because I think that sends a signal about this idea that it's part of a general set of responsibilities that we have to each other and to the academic community that we're a part of, as external examining is, as is doing research and scholarship. They're part of what we do, and they're part of what makes the community lively and developing and not stagnating.
From the perspective of me as a reviewer, whenever a manuscript comes in that's something that's my area, there's probably a 75% chance I can guess with relative accuracy who wrote it anyway. You know, I exist in a small area. So the idea of blindness is really only one-sided as it is.
Yes.
There are definitely other subfields that might not have that same capacity, but at least a benefit from being in a relatively, you know, small, constrained subfield is I'm probably going to be right in knowing who the reviewer is or who the author is.
And shouldn't we be interested in trying to demystify some of this process?
The question is then, how do you demystify it?
So part of that, I think, would be publishing the names of the reviewers, I think. I think the kind of the blind review followed by the publishing of the names, I think, is one step, quite an important step towards doing that. The other step starts, as you were saying before, particularly you, Jeremy, talking about your experience and you, Bruce, about working with doctoral students, seeing your role as supervisors when you're asked to review, to ask your students to engage in it as well. As a learning process, there's something about seeing the whole, the needs of the doctoral student in the whole, rather than just completing their PhD. It's about what they will then contribute and bring to the broader academic community.
You're thinking on the training process first. One of the things that there has been some studies of is that when people are overly critical and attacking the person or whoever it is that's doing the research, the first manuscript I ever sent out as a author myself, for instance, one of the reviewers made the comment that I should probably quit and find a different career because I was absolutely horrible at research and they can't believe I was allowed to submit to the journal in the first place.
That was helpful.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have written that about your paper.
Well, see, I knew that was you, but...
No, of course not.
But. I have no idea who that was. But, I mean, that's an extreme. But I've never seen someone quite submit that extreme of a review in my role as an editor. But anytime you are going after the individual or the individual's approach, well, it crosses a little bit of a line, but it also discourages others or whoever is receiving that review from engaging in the academic process. So there was a study that came out, I think it was about 2 years ago, and I'll have to, that showed where the more negative the review was about the reviewer themselves, the more it pushed them out of an academic career. And that became a larger effect if it was the author is a female or the author is a minority. That right. As we're trying to encourage diversity within the field, as we're trying to encourage more people to come in and engage on research, the easiest way to push somebody out was to have this negative experience that the reviewer was providing because of that anonymity behind what they could do.
So whilst I'd be careful about using Twitter as a kind of, you know, completely solid basis for my research, the thing that stimulated this our conversation, Bruce, that came out of Twitter, so that young early career researcher was a woman. The review was the equivalent of how you described one of the ones that you've received. It was, you really should stop now. And that generated a number of other people saying, that's also happened to me. So I think that would validate what you were saying about the research that was done a couple of years ago.
Yeah. You know, I received dozens of messages after that
yeah.
from people who were unwilling to post it live, but were messaging me going, you know, thank you for speaking out against this. Yes. On the other hand, I had messages from several senior scholars who were like, well, that's just how things are. And I'm like, but that's not how things should be.
No. No. They shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, I think you incur an obligation to be respectful of the individual and the time and effort that they've invested in the research when you agree to review a piece. And if you can't, you know, if you can't isolate yourself and present an unbiased analysis of the work on its, you know, on its own merits, then I think there's a deeper problem. So what is a journal review? It's an opportunity to look at a manuscript and to provide feedback to the author about where they could improve, what they've done well. It's an opportunity to provide feedback to the editor about the likelihood of a manuscript being publishable in their journal with or without edits. But, you know, then again, what is a manuscript review not? It's not a barrier to entry. It's not a gatekeeping function that limits access to journals, or at least it shouldn't be. And it's not an opportunity for you to feel big and demean other people because there's a kind of a principal agent relationship here. There's a person with power and a person without power in this peer review process. And, you know, it's not an opportunity to exercise some sort of power that doesn't really exist. I mean, yes, you have the power probably to keep a journal from publishing someone's article, but that's not the purpose. It's not a gatekeeping function. It's not a barrier to entry. It is an opportunity to evaluate and to provide guidance. And I think that's sometimes where we just fall short. We don't all view it as a mentoring role, a mentorship process. And that's what it could be. That's what it should be. You know, yes, we do need to know whether the piece is good enough to publish, but we also would like to see this author succeed in their career. And so, no, maybe it's not perfect, and maybe it doesn't need to be published in PAR or public administration or teaching public administration, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be published somewhere. And we just have to keep sight of the fact that these decisions we're making really do affect people's lives. I mean, Bruce is citing research, but, you know, to me, it's very personal. I can't remember a rejection decision that I got from a journal that I felt good about. But, you know, you should at least be able to look at the reviews and say, okay, well, I actually did good work, but I could improve. I'm not a terrible person. I haven't selected the wrong career. I should keep going and find a journal that's willing to publish this. I think they're just two very different ways of perceiving this.
I think that's really, really important. And I think that that way you've summarized it, I think is really critical, and both for a reminder to us actually about it. I mean, there's a reminder to editors about the peer review process is not acting as a gatekeeper. And there may be, in the pressure of dealing with, you know, quantities of manuscripts, that we default unintentionally to what the reviewer says. You know, there's something about the role of editorial boards. So there's something around the ways in which journals themselves function. But critically, I think it's about us genuinely recognizing that we are talking about mentoring and supporting. And I go back to a point I was making earlier, which I think that's true for all of us, actually, not just early career researchers. I think it's true for all of us at different stages in our career, but particularly for that group at the beginning who, for whom this is a process where they don't have many reserves to fall back on. But as you said, Jeremy, there's none of us, I suspect, deal with rejection well.
You know, it's never it never feels good to be told no.
Yes.
Especially if you think about what we do to get to that point.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we work for a year or more on collecting data, writing a literature review, studying theory, putting this manuscript together, and proofing it, checking it, double checking it, and finally feeling good enough about it to actually send it somewhere for a review. And then that journal keeps it for 3 to 6 months, typically. And then you realize that you've, you know, when the decision comes back, you realize you've lost 2 years or more of your life, really, on this project. And I think that it's very easy to feel defeated when that happens. And I don't remember the occasion. I was in on a panel a couple of weeks ago for one of the conferences. Maybe it was APAM, maybe it was ARNOVA. And it was specifically geared to PhD students and young professionals. And I said, you know, my advice is actually, it wasn't about publishing so much as it was the job market in times of need. And my advice was, you know, to stop viewing things as a failure. I said, probably the reason they invited me to be on the panel is because my whole career, my whole life is characterized by one failure right after another. And I keep failing, but then I get up and I try again and something good happens. And that's exactly what you have to do in the publishing world. And it's, you know, I think reviewers could make it a little easier on the authors in this regard. You know, I'm not saying give light reviews. I'm not saying give everybody an accept, but I am saying give good feedback, be encouraging, give suggestions about where they might send the piece that would be a more appropriate outlet, so that when the reviews come back and the authors have a chance to read them, they don't feel like they've failed, but that they've moved one step closer to success. And I think that's really important, because, you know, otherwise it is. It's just one long list of failures. And people who make it to the third or fourth failure without success, it's pretty easy to just say, you know what, maybe I'm not cut out for this. But it's just that hard.
I like, you know, what you say about failure. We teach people now, not just in an academic context, but growing up, that everything is about success.
Yes.
I think at some point in our childhood, parents need to let their kids fail at something. You know, we learn more from failure than we do from success. We learn more from failure than we do from success. Failure is going to be something that we at some point encounter in our lives. If we don't learn how to deal with it, if we don't learn how to manage it, if we don't learn how to learn from the failure to go off and do something else or to do it better, that's going to cause a lot of problems. You know, just because a manuscript was rejected at a journal doesn't mean there's not another journal to send it to. I've told many people that there's always a home for a paper. It just might not be the journal that you are expecting. You know, there's about 200 journals that are classified as public administration journals. One of them will publish it. It just means you got to figure out which one it is. If you've been turned down two or three or even four journals, go find a different one. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, as long as you are making that manuscript better, using the reviews to kind of improve the manuscript over time, it will find a home.
And there, you know, I will say there are authors who get the decision and then turn the piece right back around and send it to another journal. And you would be surprised. I think authors would be surprised who do this, at how frequently journals send the piece back to the same person who reviewed it for another journal. You know, it happens to me probably once a month. I get the email back when I invite a reviewer that says, I just reviewed this for another journal, and I haven't even received the journal's decision back yet. So it happens, and, you know, if you're not going to take the feedback that the reviewers give you to heart and make an effort to revise the piece to improve it before you send it to another journal, then I think that.
No, I was just going to say that I think that it's possibly, this will sound like a, well, I think it's probably only in therapy that you get asked, why do you think you're a success? And it seems to me that the issue of failure is really important. We don't talk about it. And actually we should. That's part of the mentoring process, I think. And I think part of the difficulty, again, I think with this focus on publications and tenure and performance, is that unless you have very supportive either managers or colleagues, the tendency will not be to talk about your failures. It will just be to focus on your successes, which may well accentuate the impact that the failures have on you in a highly negative way.
One thing I do want to kind of come back to is, you know, thinking about the, since it is a episode talking about the review process, kind of talking about the problem of, or the hardness it is to find reviewers, and, you know, the kind of number of people who say no. Taylor and Francis had a week-long conference for editors where there were a whole bunch of different panels and on different topics. And one of them was on the review process and finding reviewers. And across all of the Taylor and Francis journals, only about 30% of invitations to review are ever actually accepted and the review submitted, which means 70% of the time we send off reviews, a request review, either they say yes and never turn it in, or they just turn us down or never respond, which is fairly high. What was even more interesting about that is there's a cultural aspect behind it, because the number drops if we only focus on reviewers in the United States, where it goes down to about 25% of reviewers. But if we go to someplace like China, it jumps up to about 50%. So we have kind of a different expectation from one country to the next, from one community to the next, in terms of our responsibility to do reviews, whether we actually agree to do them, kind of everything that falls into that.
Is there something, it's interesting that you're saying Taylor and Francis organized that. I'll pick that up with Sage actually, and see. I mean, within the public administration journals I'm familiar with, the same issues apply. Difficulty about getting reviewers and the demand coming through the increased numbers of papers that have been submitted. But there's something, isn't there, about, do we need to revisit, or within the public administration community, more broadly, do we need to reassert or revisit that notion of what it means to be part of a public administration community?
I think there's a value to kind of, you know, revisiting that. I never got to take a class with her because she left FSU quite quickly after I got there, but Mary Guy once made the comment of, you know, kind of her golden rule to being a reviewer: for every manuscript she sends out, she will agree to review at least the next three manuscript requests that she gets. And I think there's something to that. You know, the likelihood that the first journal we send a paper to is going to accept it is not that large. You know, let's admit, it usually takes two or three journals on average for paper to get accepted. So we should be willing to then kind of give back to the community and give back, you know, more than you've kind of taken from it. If you have three reviewers reviewing your manuscript, you should want to give back to three people, you know, to replace the work that those three reviewers did for you. You know, whether it's a 3-to-1 ratio, you know, I do think that there's a responsibility that if you're submitting, you should also be reviewing.
And without necessarily sounding completely naive, certainly seems to me within the public administration field, that would be something that's kind of congruent, isn't it, with the sort of the values and the kind of disciplinary framework within which we work.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know how many they eventually had, but Jeremy is the first guest we've ever had back a second time, which when he was on last time, he made the comment about they had a manuscript that they had sent to 26 people at that point in time trying to find three reviewers, and they still hadn't found the three reviewers, which going to 26 would flabbergast me. Once I hit like 7 or 8, I'm already going into shock that we haven't had three people say yes.
That's the point at which we start looking for really smart PhD students to read things. It is frustrating, and it's, you know, I wouldn't say that that happens often, but, and I hope, I haven't checked, I hope that one still holds the record, but it was on a topic that is fairly what I would consider a niche market in our field, and there are just not very many people looking at it, and it's very difficult to get an unbiased review because you know that the other two people around the world who are looking at this particular topic already know the author and know who wrote the piece even without being identified. And so, you know, usually even if you invite them, they'll decline for that reason, but not exclusively, but I'd say 50% of the time that happens. So, you know, it is very frustrating, and it takes time. I've tweaked our system at PAR so that the time for reviewers to respond to an invitation is shorter than it used to be, so that it can terminate and move on to the next one. Because, you know, if you haven't responded in a week's time, you're probably not going to respond. And I think by and large, if you don't respond within a day, you're probably not going to respond. But I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. People take vacations. People have things going on. So you don't want to exclude a potential reviewer just by withdrawing the invitation too soon. But at the same time, if you wait a week 26 times, that's, I believe that's 6 months. So, you know, you have to do something to try to get reviews in quickly as a service to the field. And that's the other side of this. The authors are sitting out there waiting, twiddling their thumbs, wondering. Anxiety is another problem for our field, you know, for researchers in general, I guess, scholars. Waiting for that result to come back and not knowing is very frustrating. So we try to be as quick as possible. And, you know, that's the exception, not the rule. But we really do hope that people will view this as an altruistic behavior and an altruistic activity, just like blood donation, and you know, just suck it up and spend an afternoon or a day or whatever it takes and read a manuscript for us. It's I still agree to review manuscripts, and I'm frankly, I don't know how I find the time to do the things I'm already doing, but you know, when I get one that's interesting, I will review it for another journal. And I enjoy reading manuscripts because it keeps me abreast of what other people are doing. What's the state of scholarship in this area? What are the interesting questions? What's changed since I last wrote about this? So it's, you know, I get something out of it. It's not just a give, give, give. It's a give and get relationship. And so I like to read other people's work. I like to see what they have to say. I like to see how they approached a problem or a question. And, you know, to me, it's a value. I shape my perspective around the things that I read. And heaven knows I read more than I ever dreamed I would. Good and bad, publishable and not. You know, I know a lot of the stuff that people are working on right now, but it's, you know, it's a very... It's a very humbling, I think, perspective to see how little my contributions will ultimately make in such a big and beautiful field. But, you know, I really do enjoy being part of it just the same.
I think that point about how niche some areas are, which is a kind of a sign, I guess, of the developments in the field and the kind of creation of kind of new knowledge or however we want to describe it, is quite separate, isn't it, from as a demand on getting reviewers from the more general point we've been making in this conversation, which is something around the quality of reviewers, some reviews, the need to support and train young academics and young researchers as they enter the field, and the volume of publications or the desire, the need to increase output has led to real pressures on journals finding reviewers. The kind of the niche element is quite a specialist point, isn't it, that we need to remind ourselves will be a feature, and so there are necessarily going to be limited numbers of people that we can go to. I kind of see that as different from that broader, the broader set of challenges that we face, really.
Let me ask, in terms of kind of thinking whether it's a niche area or even a broader paper, it's easy to think about public administration as being a large field, but realistically speaking, I don't think we're quite as large as it feels sometimes. I think we're kind of a very small community of network, especially compared to a lot of other fields, which means if you go to conferences, if you are engaged with the field, chances are when a manuscript comes to you as a reviewer, you might know or at least have an idea of who the author is. From your perspective as a editor, what would you tell a reviewer that's being asked? I know the temptation on other reviewers going, well, I might know or I know, so I'm going to go ahead and say no to the review. But that also automatically discounts a large number of reviewers. And sometimes that's not ideal. So what do you tell a reviewer in terms of do you want them to tell you no? Or how do you want them to balance the idea that they might know who the author is with what their job as a reviewer should be? And I don't know if that came off quite like I wanted it to, but hopefully it did.
So I think I'd probably want to know if they were personal friends, if there was a relationship. But I think you're right. If you go to conferences, you are inevitably, and you're part of a particular, maybe a subgroup or a specialist group, then you are likely to know the people writing in that field. You know, it's just you'll have met them, and you'll probably be familiar with their work. But that's not quite the same as maybe having a very close either professional relationship or personal relationship.
Yeah, this might be a bigger problem for me with JPA and you for TPA than PAR, given the teaching and learning community is a lot smaller.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we get the same thing quite often at PAR. Sometimes it's, I think I know who this is. Sometimes it's, I've read an earlier draft of this paper and offered feedback. So, you know, there are, I guess, different gradations in terms of the extent of potential bias. And if it's just suspected or hypothetical, then I usually say, go ahead and read it if you can be unbiased. But if, you know, if it's a direct kind of involvement, a direct bias and very difficult to obfuscate, then I say, yeah, probably best that we find somebody else. And, so, you know, we try to give the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, if they aren't absolutely certain that it's a paper by someone else, then I think they've created the necessary doubt in their own mind to be able to do it. But, you know, that brings up another interesting concern, and some reviewers are very adept at using this to get out of work. It's kind of a gotcha. So we see a lot of people posting early drafts on the various sharing platforms, SSRN, ResearchGate, you name it, they're out everywhere. And So you invite somebody and the response that they send back is, oh yeah, I see so-and-so wrote this. They've got an early draft up on ResearchGate. So I guess I can't review it. And, you know, that's the next dilemma. As we begin to share early drafts of our work, I mean, if we go to conferences, we're seeing early drafts of the work anyway, right? So it's not, it's usually not that clear cut, but this is, I probably get more questions about this now than I have in the last 2 years. People who are interested in submitting manuscripts to PAR ask me directly, you know, I've got a pre-publication version of this up on a website. Does that forbid me from submitting? And, you know, it's a question that we're going to have to address more succinctly and clearly, I guess, in the future. But for now, it's, I mean, I only mentioned it because of the reviewer connection, but it's the next great dilemma for me in figuring out how to shape my responses to those questions.
There's a email group of editors that crosses kind of political science, PA, and international affairs. And one of the editors emailed probably 2 or 3 weeks ago asking about, you know, how you deal with the pre-publication posts of, you know, the working papers online. It does start to kind of bring up concerns about the blindness and the fairness of the review process as a result of having those out there. But I think having that early aspect posting of the papers is actually a good thing for the field. But it is entirely possible that I am alone.
No, I think it's good. My perception is that if someone has gone to the trouble of soliciting feedback on their work, and you know, made sure that it's in a second or third draft by the time it gets to the journal, I think it stands a much higher likelihood of success in the review process. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that bias couldn't creep in and the result could ultimately be attributable to the fact that somebody figured out that it was a prominent author in the field whose paper they were reading. But, you know, I just think it does improve the work. You know, earlier in the conversation, we were talking about what can we do? How can we demystify the process? And I mean, the only suggestion that I think, that the only tangible suggestion, I think, was that we begin publishing the names of the reviewers along with each article. But, you know, I'm curious, are there other things that we can do? Are there other approaches that we could try that don't do away with double blind peer review, but, you know, chip away at it enough to open the black box and maintain the integrity of the process while also revealing enough of it that people, I guess I keep thinking ever since it was mentioned, I keep thinking that if I am invited to review a piece and I know my name will be published with the article, that, you know, if it's accepted, I feel like I'm going to give a better review. I'm going to do a better job. I want to try harder to make sure that I do a good job. And I mean, I think that's a fine idea. Maybe it doesn't give the necessary credit to folks who review pieces that don't make it that far. But you know, I'm open-minded about these sort of things. I would like to hear other ideas. I would like for people to give me suggestions about what we could think about doing. I've got 3 more years with PAR. I have 3 more years to make a small impact. And, you know, that's kind of how I see my job. Moving the journal into a position to be better off in 3 years than it is now. And
so it seems to me that the two, there are at least many more than two, but the two kind of groups that are represented in this conversation are those submitting the papers and those who both review, but there's a subset, those of us that commission the reviews. And so I think something about the early publication of your thoughts on what are essentially non-reviewed platforms like ResearchGate, is a way of saying to the writer, the scholar, actually what's important is putting your work out in the public domain. You can do that in a variety of ways, but part of that process will be challenge, will be question, will be how you defend what you're saying and how you advance the case that you want to make. The review process that leads to publication is our attempt to introduce some kind of quality check, isn't it? Some kind of independent level of scrutiny. That doesn't have to be in secret. That scrutiny can be subject to being open in the way that you were suggesting earlier on, Bruce. And that the writer, the academic, the scholar, understands that their work is going to be subject to fair and independent scrutiny, and that's as it should be. But in order to get the benefits of that, I think we need to give more support to them, and in order to give support to reviewers so that they feel that they are contributing something, then I think that idea of the principle of give back, the principle of we're contributing to a broader community, whilst altruistic and might not seem very practical, sorry Jeremy, might help to change the way we have this conversation.
As an editor, my temptation is to go the mile and, you know, post who the reviewer names. There's a number of health journals that even go further, where they will post supplemental material, the initial submission, the reviews, the reviewer names, the response to reviewers. They basically post everything up online so you can kind of watch and see the process. Given the journals in the field, of course, it's a public registration. If one journal, you know, went that far, the likelihood that they would have submissions probably starts going down. You know, so the concern becomes, you know, how do you make the changes without killing off or having a severe consequence to the journal at the same time? You know, that's a challenge. As a editor, I know what I do when I have the reviews come back where somebody kind of makes those, you know, nasty, uncalled for comments. I will reopen the review and send it back to the reviewer and say, can you change this part? Because that's not part of the process, you know, that we are looking for. Sometimes they will, sometimes I never hear back from them. But if I don't hear back from them, I'll go ahead and make that change myself and set it off in order to kind of ensure that there's a positive aspect to the review process.
And just so that we're all clear, I mean, we know this, but I think some of our peers may not hear it this way. This is not about giving feedback, which is asking for changes or recommending changes or trying to raise the quality of the work. It's about doing it in a way that's going to secure the most positive response.
Right.
Isn't it? Even though we accept that people will hear it as a rejection, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of how we could create a larger change for the journals. But it is relatively difficult with only having a small number. But between JPay, Taylor and Francis, TPA at Sage, and then PAR and PA, both with Wiley, you know, the three of us have a very large opportunity to still make changes and to do some, you know, kind of good for the field in that way.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it's a number of journals and three publishing houses we're talking about.
Right.
Aren't we? With quite significant reach, taking the journals together. We're talking about, you know, a large constituency, aren't we?
Yeah, at the very least, we have the three of us in this, you know, perhaps, you know, whether you want to call it an early conversation or not, you know, the three of us kind of sitting around having the conversation about, you know, the peer review process and how do we fix it. I think, you know, as an editor, the two biggest, you know, challenges that I see right now are getting people to engage and, you know, do those reviews. And if you want to submit to the journal, you know, contribute back to the journal as well by agreeing to review. It doesn't have to be every time. But on the other hand, if you're engaging with the journal, be the kind of reviewer that you wish you had. Don't go after somebody. Don't attack the individual. Be constructive without being critical. when you submit your own stuff to us, your past information about your review behavior is going to pop up there because we can, you know, see your history surrounding. And not that I don't think any of us would ever specifically exclude somebody because of past negative reviewer behavior, but with the sheer number of manuscripts that come in, do something to your advantage and make sure that when we see something, we go, oh, this is from so-and-so, not going, oh crap, this is from whoever.
Yeah. When I look at a piece that's coming in, I mean, the first thing I see is the name of the author. You know, and I click not very many links to find out their history. And I usually don't have to click any links. I mean, I know, how many times I've invited people to review roughly in my mind. I know roughly how many times they've rejected my, invitation. I shouldn't say rejected, declined my invitation, and how many times they've accepted it. But, you know, I mean, that doesn't play a role in the peer review process because that happens down the line. I read the piece, I think about its merits, and then it goes into a sort of a holding pen, if you will, while I think about who might review it. And typically I have managing editors help me go through and identify some of the prospective reviewers for a piece so that I take out what little bias I might have manifested in in the initial part of the process. But, you know, it's, to me, it is frustrating to know that you're getting three manuscripts a year, four manuscripts a year from somebody who has refused to read everything you've sent them. That just doesn't say good citizen. And if there's one moral to this whole story, I would say it's just, you know, be good people. Be good people. Be good to each other. And, you know, agree to those reviews. Do a good job when you get them. Treat each other with respect as scholars, as members of the PA community, and we'll end up with a better result.
It's that notion of citizenship, isn't it? Good citizenship, which I think is really, really crucial to this.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good place for us to stop on. So I want to thank you both for your time and for coming on and talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Bruce. Really good to meet you, Jeremy.
Likewise, John. Pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.